Good morning. It's Tuesday, the 6th of January, and you're listening to the Wall Street Journal here on Sun Sounds of Arizona with your volunteer reader, Chuck Kaufman. Today, we have these headlines from the front page of the Wall Street Journal. I am innocent, Maduro tells judge. Hospitals become test labs for AI. And White House firms win key concessions in global tax deal. Our first article is by Corinne Ramey and James Finelli. I am innocent, Maduro tells judge. Ousted Venezuelan leader calls himself prisoner of war at hearing in New York. Ousted Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro pleaded not guilty to drug trafficking charges during his arraignment at U.S. federal court in New York City on Monday, defiantly telling a judge that he was still the head of his nation despite being whisked away by U.S. forces over the weekend. I am innocent. I am not guilty. I am a decent man. I am still the president of my country, he said through a Spanish interpreter, adding that he was a prisoner of war and had been kidnapped from his home in Caracas. Maduro's top lieutenant, Delcy Rodriguez, was sworn in as Venezuela's acting president Monday as remnants of the regime moved swiftly to assert control. Security officers were out in force in Caracas, running checkpoints and patrolling neighborhoods to prevent protests. The raid in which Maduro was arrested generated criticism Monday at the United Nations, where the U.S. was accused by several countries of violating global rules and norms it helped craft. French envoy J. Darmadhirkari said, an act that contravenes U.S. principles chips away at the very foundation of international order. In Manhattan, Monday's hearing kicked off a nearly unprecedented legal battle over a foreign leader in a U.S. court. The arrest of a head of state presents challenges for both prosecutors and the defense, and the two sides could spend years sparring over the legality of Maduro's arrest and charges before he goes to trial. Maduro, who ruled his country for more than a decade, shuffled into court in shackles before being seated next to his lawyer. He shook hands with those around him and wished people in the packed courtroom a Happy New Year. When Maduro continued to argue in court that he was wrongfully apprehended, the judge interjected, telling him there would be a time and place to make those arguments. Maduro's wife, Celia Flores, sat at the same defense table, showing what her lawyer said were signs of injuries sustained during her capture. The Maduros faced charges including cocaine importation conspiracy and possession of machine guns. The two defendants are being detained at a federal jail in Brooklyn. Their lawyer said neither was seeking bail but might do so in the future. The U.S. captured Maduro and his wife early Saturday during a military operation. Maduro's lawyer, Barry Pollack, told the judge that before trial he planned to make arguments about the legality of Maduro's abduction and his immunity as a head of state. The closest comparable case to Maduro's involves drug trafficking charges brought against Manuel Noriega, the former Panamanian strongman whom the U.S. captured after invading the country in 1989. He was convicted in federal court in Miami and sentenced to 40 years in prison. He tried to assert head of state immunity, saying the charges were unlawful. However, a federal appellate court shot down the argument. U.S. prosecutors had previously charged Maduro in 2020 and by 2025 offered a reward of up to $50 million for information leading to his arrest. The U.S. doesn't recognize him as Venezuela's legitimate president. The new indictment, unveiled Saturday, just hours after the incursion into Venezuela, accuses Maduro, Flores, and four other defendants with a 25-year-long conspiracy that involved partnering with violent drug traffickers to distribute tons of cocaine to the U.S. Maduro sits atop a corrupt, illegitimate government that for decades has leveraged government power to protect and promote illegal activity, including drug trafficking, prosecutors wrote. The indictment alleges that Maduro took steps to advance a conspiracy, including selling Venezuelan diplomatic passports to drug traffickers and ordering kidnappings and murders against people he believed owed him drug money. Outside the courthouse Monday, police set up barriers along the sidewalks, which were packed with dozens of chanting protesters, including some carrying signs saying, USA hands off Venezuela. Inside the courtroom, a man stood up after the hearing and shouted to Maduro in Spanish. I'm a prisoner of war, Maduro said in Spanish as court officers escorted the other man out of the room. Flores also pleaded not guilty. We look forward to reviewing and challenging the evidence the government has, her lawyer said. The next hearing has been set for March 17th. The Justice Department had previously charged former heads of state. In 2024, federal prosecutors obtained a conviction of former President Juan Orlando Hernandez of Honduras for drug trafficking and weapons conspiracies. President Trump pardoned Hernandez in November. And that's I am innocent, Maduro tells judge. Next we have hospitals become test labs for AI. This is by Taiping Chen and Chao Deng. Samir Aboud, chief of emergency radiology for Northwestern Medicine, thought he was already working at maximum speed in a carefully honed routine. Aided by voice dictation, he could finish writing an X-ray report in as little as 75 seconds. Then the Chicago-based health system rolled out generative artificial intelligence in 2024 that can analyze patient scans and write reports. Aboud, who checks the AI work for potential changes, said reviews have sped up to about 45 seconds. The result was breathtaking and startling. It was the first time I felt like there was a clock on my career, Aboud said. Still, he said, humans are a necessary part of the process, and reading scans faster can come with benefits, too. There's hundreds of patients waiting for our read, and any one of them could be the one that's actively dying, Aboud said. Big hospital systems have become the proving ground for widespread AI adoption, testing what the technology can do, but also revealing sometimes, via alarming mishaps, where it falls flat. Among health systems, 27% are paying for commercial AI licenses, triple the rate across the U.S. economy, according to a Menlo Ventures and Morning Consult survey. While the aging population's healthcare needs rise, hospitals are looking for ways to deal with persistent worker shortages that can burn out clinicians and delay care. They're also looking for efficiency while cuts to Medicaid loom. AI has especially broken through in some of the least flashy but most labor-intensive hospital tasks, taking notes, fielding patient phone calls, and dealing with insurance claims. These tasks are often labor-dependent, with the same rote process done thousands of times, said Rupal Malani, a senior partner at a consulting firm, McKinsey, who advises health systems on AI manipulation. Doctors still make medical decisions, though AI can aid the process. A University of California, Los Angeles study found last year that AI was better able to identify subtle signs of breast cancer that can develop and grow undetected between routine screenings. The study estimated that using AI to help screen patients could reduce such breast cancers by 30%. At the same time, there are reasons for caution. Mayo Clinic cardiologist Paul A. Friedman turned to ChatGPT when he needed to weigh in on a patient who needed a defibrillator implantation a few days after having heart surgery. Friedman thought such a procedure was feasible and safe, but wanted to know whether there were case studies. ChatGPT gave him references to several reports published in medical journals that said it showed such a procedure was safe and effective. Friedman said it looked very realistic until a colleague tried searching for the studies, only to discover they were fabricated. After that, Friedman says he takes a trust but verify approach. It's not that I don't ask ChatGPT medical questions, but when I do, I always look for the references, click on them, and read the abstracts at a minimum, he said. The hospital's cardiology department is testing alternative in-house AI tools. A representative for ChatGPT parent, OpenAI, said that its teams run evaluations to reduce harmful or misleading responses and that its latest models are much more able to provide accurate information than previous versions, such as the one Friedman would have used. ChatGPT wasn't intended to be a substitute for guidance from health professionals, the company said. An October study in The Lancet, Gastroenterology and Hepatology, found that physicians who used AI for 3 months to aid them in spotting growths during colonoscopies were able to detect significantly fewer such growths once the tool was taken away. I'm constantly worried about myself with de-skilling, said Anthony Cardillo, a New York City pathologist who directs Memorial Sloan Kettering Laboratory, specializing in blood samples. Anytime I outsource my thoughts to something that isn't my own brain, I'm worried that I'm going to lose that muscle memory. Cardillo said that he and his colleagues use generative AI to review specimens, but do so only as a second pair of eyes after coming up with their own diagnoses. Despite such concerns, health systems said they see tremendous promise and necessity. When you think about the tsunami of need that's coming as a society, technology is one of the only levers we have to pull, said Doug King, Northwestern Medicine's Chief Digital and Innovation Officer. At Northwestern, an AI review of 1 million scans taken over a year highlighted 70 that humans hadn't flagged for further review. A manual check then showed 5 instances where physicians deemed that more follow-up was needed. Northwestern is using another AI tool to schedule operating room time more efficiently, which means more patients can be treated, officials there said. Hospitals were early AI users. Predictive algorithms have powered early warning systems for sepsis, flagged high-risk patients, and helped manage scheduling for years. In Northern California, Kaiser Permanente's 21 hospitals use a system that analyzes all patients' vitals and charts and scores them every hour to determine which patients are at highest risk. A study in the New England Journal of Medicine found the system saves more than 500 lives a year. On a recent day, the system determined that a heart failure patient required more scrutiny, leading physicians to learn he was also suffering from a severe respiratory virus and needed steroids for his lungs, said Vincent Liu, a pulmonary critical care physician at Kaiser Permanente Santa Clara Medical Center. Hospitals are aggressively adopting AI for tasks that are less flashy but take up a significant amount of time and resources. Electronic medical record provider Epic Systems in 2024 launched a tool that uses generative AI to mine patient records and draft appeal letters to insurance companies. About 1,000 hospitals are already using the system, the company said. Northwestern routinely has to appeal about 5 to 10% of the millions of claims it processes every year, said David Plonick, vice president of information technology there. You're spending so much staff overhead and work trying to fight them and appeal to them and justify why we should get paid, he said. But after adopting Epic's tool, staffers now spend about 23% less time processing each denied claim, Plonick said. A similar effort at New York's Mount Sinai has led to a 3% increase in insurance denials getting overturned, helping net the health system an additional $12 million a year, said Lisa Stump, the chief digital information officer there. Mount Sinai recently paused use of an Epic generative AI tool which aimed to analyze messages patients sent to doctors and create personalized draft responses. Doctors said the drafts weren't helpful and required too much rewriting. There were some very specific mishaps, according to Ankit Sakhuja, director of Mount Sinai's AI Assurance Lab. In one case, the system told a patient who asked for a walker or cane that it couldn't help. In another, a patient reporting a headache was given a verbose response that said the patient could have anything from something minor to a brain tumor. Epic said that a small minority of hospitals have also paused use of the feature, and it is working to make improvements. The tools help nurses save as much as 30 seconds per exchange with patients through the system, Epic said, and has rolled out to about 1,700 hospitals. Still, the company said it requires human oversight. Clinicians have full control of the message that goes to the patient, said Seth Hain, Epic's Senior Vice President of Research and Development. And as hospitals become test labs for AI. Our next article, White House firms win key concessions in global tax deal. U.S. firms still face minimum taxes in many countries where they operate. This article is by Richard Rubin from Washington. The Trump administration won international tax policy concessions sought by Republicans and companies reshaping the Biden-era global corporate minimum tax deal without abandoning it. The U.S. had threatened to blow up the agreement last year, warning that it interfered with the nation's prerogative to set its own tax policy. That prompted other countries to seek a path that would accommodate concerns from President Trump and congressional Republicans. The U.S. paused those threats in late June, then the administration stayed at the negotiating table for the rest of 2025 to reach the consensus announced Monday by the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. The updated agreement achieves two main U.S. aims. First, it prevents other countries from imposing taxes on U.S. companies based on the idea that U.S. companies pay too little tax on their U.S. operations. Second, it makes minimum tax math more favorable to the U.S. research and development tax credit and similar incentives elsewhere. Those changes should shield U.S. companies from taxes that would otherwise hit them and foreign-owned companies won some reprieves, too. Keeping the U.S. inside the global deal is important because it shows continued international commitment to keeping a floor under corporate tax rates, Manal Corwin, the lead OECD official in the effort, said in an interview Monday. This outcome is a far better outcome than one that would have involved threats of retaliation or countries doing their own thing, said Corwin, previously a senior Treasury Department official under then-President Barack Obama. Monday's announcement advances the politically fraught project to prevent what officials described as a race to the bottom in corporate tax rates, where companies could shrink tax bills by booking profits in low-tax jurisdictions. Legal changes in the U.S. and elsewhere over the past decade have narrowed the gaps between countries' corporate tax rates. It's now harder, but not impossible, for companies to lower tax burdens with creative cross-border planning. There are challenges ahead, and it's an open question whether the new system, as updated Monday, will prove to be administratable and durable. Some countries will still try to use low tax rates, tax breaks, and non-tax incentives to lure investment. The U.S. imposed a minimum tax on U.S. companies' foreign income in the 2017 tax law, moving before others. In 2021, the Biden administration negotiated the global deal for a 15% minimum tax. It differed from the U.S. system, notably setting that rate floor on a country-by-country basis. It included enforcement rules that let countries impose taxes on companies whose home countries didn't fully adopt the new system, including the U.S. That piece was scheduled to take effect in 2026. The Biden administration was unable to persuade the then-Democrat Congress to build the global agreement into U.S. law. As Republicans gained power, taking the House in 2023 and the White House and Senate in 2025, they pressed their objections to what they saw as an assault on U.S. tax sovereignty. After taking office, Trump, a Republican, criticized the deal and ordered up retaliatory measures. While writing their tax law last year, House Republicans included a so-called revenge tax known as Section 899, which would have raised taxes on many foreign-based companies. The idea upset markets and worried companies. Faced with that threat, the G7 countries committed to let the U.S. system run in parallel to the global minimum tax, and broader OECD began more negotiations. The U.S. backed off the revenge tax before the final votes on the new tax law, but key lawmakers warned that they could revive it, a point reiterated Monday by the chairman of Congress's tax writing committees. If other countries delay or slow walk implementing their commitments into their domestic laws, Congress remains willing and able to take immediate action, said Representative Mike Grappo, Republican of Idaho, and Representative Jason Smith, Republican of Missouri. U.S. business groups and Republicans cheered Monday's deal, while a coalition of nonprofits warned that it does nothing to boost U.S. corporate tax revenue. This deal will shield manufacturers from damaging taxes that unfairly stifle job creation in the U.S., said Jay Timmons, president and CEO of the National Association of Manufacturers. This deal is a massive triumph for manufacturers in the United States. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent called the agreement a historic victory in preserving U.S. sovereignty and protecting American workers and businesses from extraterritorial overreach. Monday's announcement is a significant win for U.S.-based companies, particularly high-profit margin corporations that faced foreign minimum taxes on U.S. profits, said Jason Yen of accounting firm EY. Clearly, the 899 threat was quite effective in getting this across the finish line, said Yen, a former Treasury official. The context of the threats mattered. Other countries are dealing with assertive U.S. moves across multiple fronts that might be more pressing, including tariffs and national security. And they can't push back on everything simultaneously. The agreement's language on complexity and incentives also help non-U.S. countries. This is a win for the U.S., but I think it's also a win for multilateralism, said Scott Levine of law firm Baker McKenzie, who was the Biden administration's chief negotiator on international taxes. U.S. companies still face minimum taxes in many countries where they operate. Some countries might now lean more on those levies. Others, Yen said, might dial them back to attract investment from U.S. companies. Let's turn to the opinion page of the Wall Street Journal for this article by Gerald Baker. Four myths about the capture of Nicolas Maduro and the reality. It was a superbly executed act of strategic opportunism that removed a vexing enemy. For someone so voluble, President Trump isn't the most effective at articulating a rationale for his strategic thinking. His foreign policy is so unusual in the context of recent history that almost every action he takes is subject to a range of fevered interpretations from friends and critics alike. So, it was last weekend, following the military operation to remove Nicolas Maduro, dictator of Venezuela, and bring him to the U.S. for trial. The daring enterprise has engendered a host of grand theories about Mr. Trump's strategic decision-making, the ideas behind it, and its implications. In all this exegesis, there are at least four myths and one important truth. Myth one. This is a law enforcement operation to bring to justice a notorious narcotics trafficker. The officially stated reason for Operation Absolute Resolve is also the least plausible. I have great regard for Jay Clayton, the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York, and I have no doubt he will bring a watertight case against Mr. and Mrs. Maduro. But no one buys the claim that this was an initiative primarily in pursuit of criminal justice. Mr. Maduro and his wife pleaded not guilty Monday. For one thing, the last Latin American head of state convicted in a U.S. court on drug trafficking charges was just granted a pardon by Mr. Trump. So the administration's commitment to rooting out narco presidents seems less than solid. For another, Mr. Trump, with his characteristically blunt capacity to say things that contradict his own officials, waxed lyrical all weekend about the operation's blessings for Venezuelan freedom, democracy, oil, and the Donroe Doctrine. Which brings us to myth two. The removal of Mr. Maduro will result in an energy bonanza for the U.S. The prospect of access to oil was surely a big factor in the decision to effect a regime change, but its implausibility lies in the unlikelihood of its being realized. There has been excited commentary about how Venezuela sits atop 300 billion barrels of oil, and how that means at current crude prices that the U.S. just took control of an asset worth $17 trillion. This is flawed thinking geologically, mathematically, and economically. The country's heavy oil isn't easily extracted. It will require massive capital expenditure to get back to the 3 million barrels a day the country was producing a few years ago. In the unlikely event it did open up significant additional production, the addition to world supply would depress oil prices for many U.S. energy producers. $50 a barrel oil is below production cost. Whatever benefits may flow from Venezuela won't change America's energy equation. Myth 3. This latest exercise in U.S.-led regime change represents the ultimate discrediting of America First foreign policy restrainers. Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene transfigured in the media from her previous role as everyone's favorite nut job to her new status as sagacious observer of geopolitics, was widely quoted making this case: regime change, funding foreign wars, and America's tax dollars consistently funneled to foreign causes is what has most Americans enraged, she tweeted. But Mr. Trump's foreign policy was never as restrained as some of his supporters wanted it to be. As he showed in his first term with the successful strikes against Iran's Qasem Soleimani and Islamic State's Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, he's never been shy about deploying U.S. force. The same was true for the attack on Iran's nuclear facilities last summer. The Maduro raid is entirely consistent, a quick and apparently successful strike that delivers a blow to America's enemies without resulting in lengthy entanglements. Myth 4. The operation is a disastrous break with U.S. historical respect for international law and sets a terrible precedent that will be exploited by Russia and China as an excuse to achieve their own objectives. Give me a break. Two, actually. First, the U.S. has a long history of removing unfriendly leaders on questionable legal grounds, going back at least three quarters of a century. From Iran's Mohammad Mossadegh in 1953 to Chile's Salvador Allende in 1973, Panama's Manuel Noriega in 1989 to Iraq's Saddam Hussein in 2003 and many more in between. What's more, this latest action hardly constitutes a green light for dictators everywhere. Senator Mark Warner, Democrat of Virginia, suggested the seizure of Mr. Maduro would now be emulated. What prevents China from claiming the same authority over Taiwan's leadership? What stops Vladimir Putin from asserting a similar justification to abduct Ukraine's president? I have news for Mr. Warner. Mr. Putin has not declined to capture Vladimir Zelensky because of his deep regard for the niceties of law. Xi Jinping, fresh off defying international law in the South China Sea and tearing up his country's treaty with the UK over Hong Kong, isn't somehow being prevented from seizing Taiwan's leader because some lawyer in Beijing has been telling him that isn't how America behaves. So much for the myths. The reality is this. The Maduro grab was a superbly executed act of strategic opportunism that removed a troublesome enemy in the region most vital to U.S. interests. Ultimate judgment on it will rest on its long-term outcome. But for now, it sends a message to friends and foes alike. We have the capacity and the will to eliminate ruthlessly those who would cause us harm. And that's four myths about the capture of Nicolas Maduro from the opinion page of the Wall Street Journal. This is your volunteer reader, Chuck Kaufman, reminding you that you can listen to the Wall Street Journal and other Sun Sounds of Arizona programming either as it streams or at a time of your choosing by simply going to the Sun Sounds of Arizona website at sunsounds.org or by downloading the Sun Sounds of Arizona app, available for your Android phone or tablet from the Google Play Store or for your Apple phone or tablet from the Apple App Store. And you can always listen to Sun Sounds of Arizona streaming on your Amazon Dot, Echo, or Show. We'll turn now to the business and finance section of the Wall Street Journal for these headlines. Carmakers signal tough year ahead. Oil stocks, banks pushed out a record finish. And MIT physicist has appealed to Pope and Musk on AI safety. That first article, car makers signal tough year ahead. Sales expected to slow after years of gains as consumers push back on prices. This is by Christopher Ottz and Sharon Turlip. General Motors and several rivals reported year-end sales slumps, an ominous sign that U.S. auto sales will slow this year as consumers push back on higher prices. GM, the biggest automaker in the U.S. by sales and a bellwether for the U.S. industry, said Monday that sales fell 7% in the final quarter of 2025. Honda, Hyundai, Mazda, and Nissan also said on Monday that their U.S. sales fell toward the end of the year. Analysts and automakers predict U.S. annual sales will fall in 2026 following three straight years of gains as belt-tightening American car buyers collide with tariff costs that companies probably won't keep absorbing. Executives at Toyota, which notched an 8% increase in U.S. sales during the fourth quarter, said they're preparing for a bruising year ahead. Toyota was able to maintain sales momentum at the end of last year by absorbing the costs of U.S. tariffs and because carmakers gravitated toward the company's entry-level models like the Corolla sedan. Yet, executives said companies won't be able to keep footing the bill for tariffs. Prices are going to go up for us and for our competitors, David Crist said, Toyota's U.S. sales chief. Last year's U.S. auto sales defied the industry's worst-case scenarios triggered by the Trump administration's initial tariff plans. Instead, the administration eased the tariffs and consumers rushed to buy electric vehicles ahead of the end of federal tax credits in September. Overall, U.S. auto sales rose about 2% from 2024 to about 16.3 million, according to J.D. Power. For 2025, General Motors said total sales were up 6%. Nearly a quarter of its volume represented vehicles that start under $30,000, such as the popular Chevrolet Trax compact crossover. Yet, the reticence from car buyers toward the end of 2025 portend a potentially volatile year marked by uncertainty around tariffs and the broader economy. What we saw in 2025 is going to bleed into 2026, Randy Parker, chief executive of Hyundai Motor America, which reported sales slid 1% in the fourth quarter. The world's biggest automakers took multi-billion dollar hits on tariff costs in 2025, though the Trump administration walked back some automotive duties. Toyota swallowed higher tariff costs to avoid a hit to sales, but the move came at a cost. The company's North American business swung to a loss in the 6 months ended September 30th from a year earlier profit. There are a lot of questions on our side whether the consumer could handle higher prices offsetting tariff costs, Toyota's Chris said. If we priced it all in, what would our sales look like? Consumers also face more expansive insurance, financing, and maintenance expenses in addition to higher new car prices. The average monthly payment on a new vehicle hit a record $776 in December, J.D. Power said. The cumulative weight of all these increases has pushed total vehicle ownership costs beyond reach for many middle and lower income households, Cox Automotive economist Jeremy Robb said. Honda suffered one of the biggest quarterly sales slides, with U.S. sales down 9.5% in the fourth quarter. Honda's production was hit by a shortage of semiconductor chips stemming from turmoil at the Chinese-owned, Dutch-based Nexperia. Nissan said its U.S. sales fell 3.7% in the fourth quarter. Mazda, another major Japanese automaker selling in the U.S., said sales in December fell 19% compared with a year earlier. Jeep maker Stellantis said U.S. fourth quarter sales jumped 4% compared with an especially bleak quarter a year earlier. Stellantis, faced with years of plummeting market share, last year slashed prices and increased promotions and other financial sweeteners. Further cuts to interest rates could lower the cost of car payments and bolster demand. President Trump's new tax deduction for auto loan interest could also spur demand for vehicles assembled in the U.S. In addition, automakers are looking for a U.S. trade deal with Canada and Mexico that would reduce the current 25% tariff on vehicles assembled in those countries. We are very hopeful that something happens with Mexico and Canada, so at least we can establish, okay, this is the new normal, and then plan for it, Toyota's Chris said. And that was Carmakers Signal Tough Year Ahead. Our next article by Hannah Aaron Lang and David Uberti, oil stocks and banks push Dow to record finish. Stocks are launching into the new year with a boost from the oil industry. After a sluggish start to 2026, stocks kicked off the first full week of the year on a high note, with the Dow Jones Industrial Average rising 594.79 points or 1.2% to a record 48,977.18. Oil stocks and other related names jumped after the U.S. ousted Venezuelan leader Nicolas Maduro in a surprise military operation over the weekend. President Trump pledged to dispatch American drillers to revive the country's crude output. Chevron, the one major U.S. oil company still active in Venezuela, saw some of the biggest gains Monday. The shares jumped 5.1% and helped power the Dow Jones Industrial Average to its first intraday high above 49,000. The S&P 500 rose 0.6%, while the NASDAQ Composite advanced 0.7%. Other fuel makers, including Phillips 66 and Valero Energy, also jumped. Oil field service stocks were other market leaders. SLB trailed only Valero among the biggest gainers in the S&P 500, with competitor Halliburton not far behind. Moves in oil prices themselves were relatively muted. Brent crude futures, the benchmark for international prices, initially fell before rebounding to trade 1.7% higher at $61.76 a barrel. Energy analysts expect it will take years and significant investment to ramp up production in Venezuela, and getting foreign companies to flock back to the country will be an enormous challenge. There's a huge opportunity, but there's also a huge risk, said Rob Thummel, senior portfolio manager at Tortoise Capital. No company, probably even globally, is going to make an investment without political stability and clarity. It's going to take years rather than days or months before anyone goes in and commits capital. Chevron probably has the best chance at capitalizing on any new opportunities, Thummel said. The Venezuelan government for decades has swung between working with and against U.S. oil companies, pushing ExxonMobil and ConocoPhillips out of the country in the 2000s. Even if the U.S. and Venezuelan governments are able to convince investors of political and legal stability going forward, analysts warn that current oil prices may discourage investments that span years and total billions. Domestic U.S. oil producers, meanwhile, were hit, with Devon Energy and Diamondback Energy among the S&P 500's biggest losers. An inflow of Venezuelan oil could ding the long-term demand for domestic crude. But winners extended beyond the energy sector, with financials like J.P. Morgan Chase, Citigroup, and Goldman Sachs also leading market gains. J.P. Morgan closed above the $900 billion market capital threshold for the first time on record. Those moves reflect investors' optimism for the industry in 2026, said Carol Schleff, chief marketing strategist at BMO Private Wealth, including a better environment for deal-making and the prospect of lower interest rates. Gold, typically seen as a haven in riskier times, rose 2.8%. Silver jumped 7.9% and copper gained 5% to a record. Bitcoin, the digital currency that slumped a bit in 2025, continued a hot streak, gaining 3.2% to trade above $94,000. After three back-to-back blockbuster years for stocks, investors expect the market to keep climbing this year. Schlieff said her only concern is that so many on Wall Street are in agreement on expected gains. She described the feeling as nauseously optimistic. Equity markets have shown an almost uncanny ability to look through all sorts of headlines. And that's oil stocks, banks push Dow to record finish. We now turn to MIT physicist has appealed to Pope and Musk on AI safety. This is by Keech Hagee and Sam Schechner. Max Tegmark, the MIT physics professor who has become an AI safety campaigner, emerged from days of meetings in a Vatican conference room in September with a stack of paper slips about the size of business cards. He'd been invited by the Vatican to a conclave-style meeting of academics, entrepreneurs, and human rights advocates to draft a policy appeal on AI safety to present to Pope Leo. Tegmark had been trying to get the group to oppose uncontrollable superintelligence in the text. Now it was time for a Hail Mary. He handed fellow attendee Marco Trombetti, chief executive of the AI transition company, translated one of the papers printed with a call to stall the development of AI with human-like intelligence until it could be done safely. Walking between Renaissance-era buildings, Tegmark said in a low voice, "Marco, would you sign a statement like this?" Trombetti had hesitated at first. For more than a decade, Tegmark's organization, the Future of Life Institute, had been trying to raise the alarm that advanced AI could be catastrophic to humanity. Shortly after the launch of OpenAI's ChatGPT, the Future of Life Institute made a famous call for a pause in the most advanced AI development. Now, he was asking for something even more audacious, a potential halt in the race to build superintelligence that was powering the stock market. Trombetti ultimately signed, along with more than 130,000 other people, including AI luminary Jeffrey Hinton, MAGA diehard Steve Bannon, former government official Susan Rice, and celebrities Will.i.am, Prince Harry, and Meghan Markle. Tegmark's language even found its way into the appeal to the Pope. At 58, with his trademark motorcycle jacket, mop of brown hair, and black t-shirt decrying AI with human-like intelligence, Tegmark presents a bit like a nerdy Ramon. "This is by far the most successful thing we've ever done," he said, during a recent interview near his home in the Boston suburbs, referring to the number of signatures the statement nabbed compared with the organization's past open letters. The politics of AI are changing. Concerns about risks that were once confined to debates among geeks have gone mainstream and increasingly bipartisan, fueled by fears about what AI is going to do to the job market. About half of Americans say they're more concerned than excited about AI, according to a recent Pew Research Center study, up from 37% in 2021, with concerns on both sides of the aisle. One marker of this trend, Tegmark's recent appearances on Bannon's War Room podcast, where the host said his message resonates with the far-right audience worried about jobs, despite the Trump administration's accelerationist approach to AI. "Our show is the biggest supporter of President Trump, but on this one, people want to slow down, number one, and they want guardrails," Bannon said in an interview. On the other side of the aisle, Virginia Democrat Representative Don Beyer, co-chair of the Congressional AI Caucus, agrees with Tegmark. "The people I represent are way more concerned about AI than excited about it," said Beyer. Critics of the push for regulation, such as Trump AI czar David Sacks, argue that the U.S. cannot afford to lose the AI race to China. Buttonholing Musk. Born in Sweden to a Swedish psychologist mother and an American mathematician father, Tegmark studied economics before shifting to physics, earning his Ph.D. in the subject from the University of California at Berkeley. He joined MIT's physics department in 2004. A physics conference first brought him into the orbit of Jan Tallinn, the Skype co-founder who's become one of the biggest philanthropists funding AI safety efforts. Tegmark pitched Tallinn on his vision for an organization that would help with this fight, and he agreed to fund it with an initial $100,000. Tegmark buttonholed Elon Musk at a 2014 MIT conference on space, after one of his students asked a question that prompted the billionaire's now famous quip that, "With AI, we are summoning the demon." Musk, who would later found xAI, attended a Puerto Rico conference Tegmark organized in 2015 and announced a $10 million donation to Tegmark's nonprofit. Musk didn't respond to a request for comment. Tegmark's organization received a windfall in 2021 when Ethereum co-founder Vitalik Buterin donated more than $665 million in cryptocurrency as an endowment. Months after ChatGPT's 2022 launch, the Future of Life Institute made global headlines with an open letter signed by more than 30,000 people, including Musk and Apple co-founder Steve Wozniak, calling for a 6-month pause in the most advanced AI development. Nobody paused. But Tegmark saw the exercise as a victory because it destigmatized critiquing AI development. Tegmark's latest campaign is more pointed and more populist. He says humanity can benefit from AI tools that help with specific missions, such as curing cancer, without building a general AI that could economically replace humans or take over governments. AGI is the only kind of AI that will destroy all jobs, Tegmark said. To make its point, the Future of Life Institute backed a satirical billboard campaign across San Francisco from a fake AI company, Replacement AI, that promises to replace humans in the job market. Our AI can automate all your work. No more Mondays, bosses, or paychecks. Hope you've got savings. LOL emoji, one billboard read. The organization also funds policy, research, education, and grant programs, including an AI journalism fellowship. Tegmark's views on AI have made him controversial to some in Silicon Valley. This summer, he was subpoenaed by OpenAI, which sought information on the Future of Life Institute's ties to Musk. An OpenAI spokesman referred to past statements on X from Jason Kwan, OpenAI's chief strategy officer. Kwan said subpoenas sent out to various nonprofit groups were related to a lawsuit Musk brought against the startup, challenging its ability to convert to a more traditional company structure. Tegmark has been a critic of OpenAI's conversion, but denied any current ties to Musk. The Future of Life Institute said the billionaire neither currently funds nor has any role there. The organization's call for a halt in AI development has revealed cracks in the AI safety community. The fissures are by design, according to Tegmark. Up to now, organizations backed by Tallinn and those supported by Facebook co-founder Dustin Moskovitz and his wife, Carrie Tuna, have been among the biggest funders of AI safety, often overlapping in their goals and methods. Two camps. But Tegmark said his appeals were met with rejection or silence from their charity, Coefficient Giving, recently renamed from Open Philanthropy, despite its having given more than $1 million to his organization over the years. Leaders from Anthropic, whose leadership has deep personal and philosophical ties to their charity, also didn't sign on to his appeal, Tegmark said. Anthropic declined to comment. A spokesman for Coefficient Giving said that because there's disagreement about which AI threats are most pressing, it avoids taking institutional positions that might imply a settled view about the right approach. Tegmark sees this as evidence of two camps emerging in AI safety. One that wants to build superintelligence and try to make sure it is safe, and another that doesn't want to build AI that is smarter than humans at all, unless it can be proven safe. He puts himself in the latter category. It's going to get nasty, Bannon said. You're talking about the leading source of power in the 21st century. That's MIT physicist has appealed to Pope and Musk on AI safety. Well, let's turn to the Herd on the Street section of the Wall Street Journal financial analysis and commentary for this item. Oil market shrugs off geopolitical shocks. Sanctions and fracking have changed the calculus enough to blunt the impact of Maduro's arrest and Iranian unrest. Don't adjust your screen. The oil price you're seeing is correct. The headlines from Venezuela and Iran alone, much less combined, used to be the sort of thing that sent crude prices skyrocketing. Today's market is different, and that can make a miserable stretch for energy investors even worse. Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro's arrest by U.S. forces over the weekend is the biggest threat to the regime since an attempted coup and general strike nearly forced out his predecessor Hugo Chavez 23 years ago. Oil prices rose nearly 40% in a matter of months, and then, as thousands of local oil workers were fired, and output collapsed. But Venezuela still produced more than 3% of the world's oil then, and during a time of no excess supply. Today, it's about 900,000 barrels a day, or less than 1% in a glutted market. Meanwhile, violent anti-government protests in Iran conjure up hazy memories of that country's 1979 Islamic Revolution. Crude production collapsed, erasing 7% of world supply and sending prices up 150%. Venezuela and Iran are among the five founding members of the Organizations of Petroleum Exporting Countries, and they still may matter, but far less than at the time of those upheavals. Crude prices have just fallen for an unprecedented third year in a row, and market remains seriously oversupplied as OPEC unwinds voluntary supply cuts. Furthermore, there are really two oil markets, the transparent one and the don't ask, don't tell barrels sold by countries like Russia, Iran, and Venezuela, operating under sanctions. Many follow convoluted routes via shadow tankers and are snapped up by countries like Turkey, India, and China at bargain prices. For now, the authorities in Caracas and Tehran are hanging on. Unless things become extremely violent, regime change might even be negative for crude prices, making trade more rational too. For example, the U.S. is simultaneously a huge crude exporter and importer, because its refineries were built to handle the types of crude Venezuela produces, not the lighter variety from domestic shale formations. Millions of barrels worldwide travel further and cost more than necessary to turn into things like diesel and gasoline worldwide. If recent events lead to an easing of sanctions, Monday's rally in U.S. refining and service stocks makes sense, but the enthusiasm for pure oil producers might not. Halima Croft, who heads Global Commodity Strategy at RBC Capital Markets, points out that steep costs, unresolved legal challenges, and the security situation in Venezuela make reviving production there with American participation a tall order, despite President Trump's confidence. The biggest change for the oil market since 1979 and 2003 has been in the U.S. itself. The fracking boom turned America into the top global producer and made supply more responsive to prices. Producers can ramp up or down far more quickly than during past crises or busts. Naturally, that means the risk versus reward of fixing rusting wells in an unstable country like Venezuela looks different. Fracking alters Washington's political calculus, too. Military actions like Maduro's arrest and the bombing of Iran's nuclear bunkers last June have little to no effect on pump prices and even less on the U.S. economy. This isn't your father's or grandfather's oil industry. This item was by Spencer Jacob. Oil market shrugs off geopolitical shocks. We have time for one more item. More Venezuelan crude is bad for Canadian energy. The ouster of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro is hitting Canadian energy stocks. Venezuela produces heavy oil, a direct competitor to the type that Canada produces. U.S. refining facilities, many of which were built before the U.S. became a prolific oil producer, are optimized to process this type of heavy imported crude. U.S. oil imports from Canada surpassed Venezuela starting in 1999, just after Hugo Chavez was elected president and began taking actions that led to a dramatic decline in Venezuela's oil production. Canadian oil is typically traded at a discount to the kind that is produced in the U.S. because it requires extensive processing and also has limited access to global markets. That discount has narrowed since May 2024 when an expansion to the Trans Mountain Pipeline, which carries oil from Alberta to the Canadian West Coast, eased its access to other oil markets. If more Venezuelan oil becomes available to U.S. refiners, that would widen Canadian oil's discount again. While Venezuelan oil production could take a while to ramp up, a lifting of sanctions would make more heavy crude available immediately to U.S. refiners. More Venezuelan oil would be especially bad news for Canadian oil producers with no or minimal refining capacity because they're more exposed to a widening discount in Canadian crude oil prices. These include Canadian Natural Resources, Athabasca Oil, and Strathcona Resources. Shares of these companies fell 6%, 7.4%, and 2.4% Monday, respectively. By contrast, integrated oil companies such as Suncor Energy, Cenovus Energy, and Imperial Oil should fare better. Those stocks were down 1.7%, 4.8%, and 1.4%. This article was by Jinju Lee. More Venezuelan crude is bad for Canadian energy. You've been listening to the Wall Street Journal here on Sun Sounds of Arizona with your volunteer reader, Chuck Kaufman. I'd like to thank you for joining me for this Tuesday edition of the Wall Street Journal and remind you that you can listen to the Wall Street Journal and other Sun Sounds of Arizona programming either as it streams or at a time of your choosing by going to the Sun Sounds of Arizona website at sunsounds.org or downloading the Sun Sounds of Arizona app, available for your iPhone or iPad from the Apple App Store or your Android phone or tablet from the Google Play Store. And you can listen to Sun Sounds of Arizona streaming on your Amazon Dot, Echo, or Show.